Hello, this is Jason Broadwater, and as a special episode of Old Town New World, I want to play for you all a recording that I made in 2010 of my wife's grandfather, Marshall Whitesides. He was 84 years old at the time, and in the recording, he recounts his truly incredible story of his experience in World War II. I don't want to tell you any more about the recording, as I don't want to spoil the story. I'll just say that it's like nothing that I've ever heard before, and I hope you guys find it as wonderful as I do.
I'm over with Jason in Rock Hill. I was going to give a little report on my Army career, so maybe my grandchildren or great-grandchildren might want to listen at it down the line sometime. When I was 18 years old, I'd finished Benny High School, and I was helping my dad at home on the farm. He had 175 acres. We had 10 acres of peaches, and we grew cotton, corn, wheat, and oats. And when I was 18, I was drafted, and I had a deferment. As long as I was working on the farm, I did not have to go into the service. And after a short period, I decided I couldn't do this, and I called Mr. George Estes down at the draft board and told him I wanted to go on into service. And the following week, I was reporting to the courthouse in York at 8 o'clock, and they sent me to Columbia along with a bunch more people, and down there for an examination. And I passed everything. And that afternoon, my hair was pretty long when I was 18, and anyway, the boy just started cutting my hair, went right down my forehead, cutting it off real short, just rolling it off and laughing at me. Anyway, the next day, they had us on a train going to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I thought it was going to be up there, but after a couple of days there, they were needing some combat infantry boys over in Germany, France, over in France. And so they sent us, a bunch of us, on a train to Macon, Georgia to take combat basic infantry training. And I know I was on the train. We were coming back through Rock Hill. If a train had got down about 15 miles an hour, I'd have jumped off. I was homesick, and I had never had been that far away from home in my career. But on to Macon, Georgia at Camp Wheeler. I was there for, we were going to take 17 weeks of basic training. And they were needing us over in France, so they cut it to 12 weeks and gave us 5 days to report to Fort Meade, Maryland. And at back then in 44, traffic, we didn't have the highways like we have now. And so I got to stay home a couple of days, and the rest of the days I was on my way up to Fort Meade, Maryland. At Fort Meade, when I got there, they gave us all new combat boots and combat uniforms to send us overseas. And the one thing that happened there, that day after getting ready to ship us out, it came over a loudspeaker for me to report to the main office, and the boy said, oh, he's getting out of service now. And when I got there, there was Major Stokes Robinson. It was then we spoke. I knew him well. He was from York. And he said, Marshall, I need somebody to help me get the mail around the different parts of Fort Meade. I want you to stay here with me. And anyway, dumb me, I told him I was going on. I could have retired right there at Fort Meade up there with him. I spent the rest of my Army career there. But anyway, the next day was on the way to Camp Shanks, New York. From Camp Shanks, New York, I had us all ready to board a ship to head overseas. And they had a guard on our barracks. He was walking around, and I was looking out, and I could see the bus stop over about a block and a half. Is about every 10 minutes there was a bus stopping and then picking up people. And I'd heard of 42nd Street, And I told my buddy, Red Wisham, he and I were in there, and I said, Red, I've heard of Fort Secretary. Let's go and catch that bus. I watched the guard. He's walking around the barracks, and he gets to every corner and stops and goes around. By the time he gets around the backside, we could be over there. Well, anyway, we did it, and the boys were saying, y'all go get into trouble. We got over and caught the bus, and I told the fellow I wanted to go to 42nd Street, and you could imagine the look on his face of me saying something like that. But he said, I'll tell you when to get off. Anyway, we got off and got on 42nd Street, and it's maybe 10, 11 o'clock at night, walking down the street, looking around. I told Red, I said, let's go in here and get us a drink at the bar. We went in, this had double swinging doors, it was freezing cold. And went in, walked up to the bar, and we were talking. The bartender came over, and I told him we wanted two whiskeys, and I forget what I wanted with it, but anyway, he started to turn around, started back, and he came back to me, and he got right at my face across the bar, and he said, soldier, how old are you? And being a smart aleck, I said, I'm old enough to fight for this country, and I want a drink. And he turned around and walked off, and I told Red, I said, I really told him off, didn't I, that bartender. And about that time, somebody grabbed me right in the belt loop, seat of my pants, and I was standing on my tiptoes, and I looked over Red, and he was the same way, and through those swinging doors, we was just tiptoeing. And I looked around when we hit 42nd Street out there, got straightened up and looked around. It was a bartender about, must have been 300 pounds, and looked like he had his arms crossed, just looking. There's never nothing ever said. Anyway, we left. And the next day we got on some subway or something, went out to board this ship. They put 12,000 of us on a ship, and it was a luxury liner converted into a troop ship, Old Whitfield or something like that. And my bunk is a canvas bunk. Mine was the third one up. The boy on the fourth one above me, he was so close I couldn't hardly turn over. But anyway, that went on. I spent all my money in New York. I was broke, and I got a partial pay of $40. And back then, this was in 44, I bought a carton of Camel cigarettes. And we were out of the continental United States, and a Camel cigarettes, a carton then, cost 75 cents. And I spent a little bit more of that $40 at the PX in the ship. And we had a little old slip they gave everybody. You could have two meals a day. You couldn't sit down, you had to stand up and eat. But the third or fourth day out, it was right at the head of my bunk. They were playing cards in the staircase there. And I watched them play cards just endless. The light stayed on 24 hours a day. We were down so low, you didn't know whether it was day, night or day. But I watched it about 4 or 5 days out to see. I figured out how to play poker. And when one of the boys got up and left, I eased out of the bunk down there with my money. And about 20 minutes, I was back up in my bunk, broke, lost everything I had. 14 days, we were on the ship going over and landed at Liverpool, England. Out of Liverpool, they boarded us on a train down to Southampton. They put us on a LST, you know, the old boats that carry cargo and tanks and things, where the front end opens up and a gangplank goes down. We crossed the English Channel over on one of those, had us stacked on there. Landed in Le Havre, France, and I realized then, walking down the street at Le Havre, it was torn all to pieces, and just town and everything was torn up and scary looking. But we were walking down through there, and this just single file, going to get on a train. And this girl came over to me and said, had a bottle in her hand, said, "Cognac cigarettes." And I just I had the cigarettes in my pocket. I pulled a pack out and gave her, and she handed me the bottle and a cognac. But anyway, the lieutenant saw me and gave me I won't say what he said, but anyway, he took the bottle and threw it against the wall and popped it. And anyway, that was over. But the girl got a cigarette and left. We was on this train heading up to a northern part of France and had us stacked in. It was in a boxcar type cargo. It wasn't where you could sit down anywhere, just where there's doors on the side where they loaded all kind of stuff to transfer produce or whatever, what they called. But they had us just stacked in there. But every once in a while, the train would stop. And some of us would get out, you know, and stand there for a while and jump back on when it started moving. But at the end of each boxcar, you could see this, like a ladder, you know, going up where you crawl up top. I crawled up top, and I was sitting up on top of the train looking around how pretty the country was. And all of a sudden, the train started off, and I couldn't get back down. And yeah, I was riding on top of that train. And just a little bit, I was looking where it was going, and the train I saw this tunnel it was going through. And back then, the trains burned coal, you know, there's a lot of smoke coming out from that. And I really hugged the top of this train boxcar. You won't believe how close I got down to it going through that tunnel. But it was, when it stopped on the other side, the lieutenant really gave me a hard time. I won't say what he said about me being on top of the train, but anyway, I don't know how far we were. They stopped and they would put us on trucks, split us all up, and we wound up with at some town, I don't know what it was. I joined the 14th Armored Infantry Division, and good friend Lieutenant Shaw, he rode in the half track with. He said, "I'll be riding with you in there." There was 12 of us. Plus AC, the half-track driver. He was from California, drove it. But anyway, he said, "Go down two houses down." This was way in the night, I don't know. And that's where the rest of our boys are. And he said, "There's no lights or anything. So just ease in the door and get in the hallway and just lay down and take your nap. We'll catch you in the morning." And when I woke up next morning, they were punching me. It was 11 of them looking at me, and it was kind of a hard situation. But anyway, we started out from there, and at that time we were going just from town to town, taking them. And the first town we were in, though, we had been in, just started into it, and we'd have to go from house to house. If you're familiar with over in France and Germany, the streets are real narrow. The homes and things, buildings were built back 1,000 years ago or more, and streets are of brick or rock, and everything is just solid, you know, just curving around, real narrow. But we'd have to go from house to house or building to building, and you know, it was a lot of shooting and going on. And I know the first town I was in, I was in this house, and it's in one of the rooms before I could get out. I heard this noise, and this German, just close, just came right to the door, and he looked. He didn't look well back over where I was standing, and you know, we had our bayonet on the end of an M1 rifle, and I aimed right at him. I was about 10 feet from him. I could just see his eye, and you know, I just knocked a hole through his head. But that's the first time I'd ever aimed a gun at a person. I couldn't pull a trigger, and, you know, just to see somebody you were going to kill. Anyway, he left and went on, and we fought. But Anyway, just seeing some of my buddies killed and shot. And I did shoot, but I always figured every person I shot at for mental and somebody else was shooting at them the same time I was. But this went on for a day or two, and then we were holding the line. We stayed in foxholes, German foxholes, holding the line for just days, and it snowed on us and rained. And I was, my buddy that I stayed with all the time, was, name was Cox. He was from Ohio. He carried an M16 rifle, which was like a machine gun. It was, my M1 could shoot 8 shell just real fast, but he could just go, and so I stayed with him. That was my job, to help him with the M1, and in foxholes though for days. And he was a person of, I never heard him say durned, and he'd read the Bible and pray for me at night, and he had a very religious person and just extremely nice. He was about 6'2", big blonde-headed boy, just real nice. Anyway, we went on through that, but I'm going to jump to, this was on for a couple of months going on, or maybe a month longer than that, I'm not quite sure. But I'm going to jump to the town of Steinfeld, Germany. And, well, I'll back up just a little bit. One of the, Lieutenant Johnson, my one is in charge of Company A. We were on a night patrol one night, and he got shot through the arm, and he had to leave us, and there was a Lieutenant Shaw was promoted from a sergeant to a second lieutenant, and he was in charge in some way. He and I didn't get along at all, and for some reason, I don't know. But when we got to Steinfeld, it was A, B, and C, and D Company. And there was 250 infantry, combat infantry boys like myself, in each company. And Company A was going to take the center of town, and A, B was on the left side, and C was on the right side, and D Company was back, so which while the companies had to retreat back, they could help. But we took the center road going into town, and we had to cross the Dragon's Teeth. There had to be these where a vehicle couldn't move, a tank couldn't cross it or anything. They had barbed wire, you know, all curled up in it, so you couldn't hardly walk through it. But anyway, Lieutenant Shaw said, "Marshal, Whiteside, you're going to be first scout. You're going in." Well, to be first scout, he was either going to be killed or captured. He made me take everything out of my pockets except keep my dog tags. And Munzenberger, my squad leader, he jumped on Lieutenant Shaw, and I won't say the words he said about sending me in, because I hadn't been with him that long. He said, "You know what's going to happen." And he said, "I'm going with him if you send him." And so Lieutenant, Sergeant Munzenberger and myself crossed through those barbed wire, tore our clothes. And anyway, we got on the street, on the road, a little old narrow road, paved road, going into Steinfeld. We hadn't gone but just a little piece, and the Shaw's runner come up and said if he didn't get back, he'd be court-martialed. And Munzenberger said, he put his arm around and hugged me and said, "I've got to go back, and because I'm planning on staying in service." Anyway, I headed on into town. It was a mile and 2/10 from Dragon's Teeth into Steinfeld, city limits. And you know, the houses weren't scattered out like we got around here. It was just bare until you get right into the town, and then it was solid till you go all the way through to the other side. Excuse me. And the second scout, he was in behind me about length of two lengths of a football field, and then all the companies followed that, the 1,000 was on foot and followed in behind, you know, maybe a tenth of a mile back, watching to where the first scout would catch landmines or step on trip flares and what have you. And, usually a machine gun, you know, would shoot. And, you know, one person could give his life, but maybe save a life of maybe 10 or 15 more, you know, get caught in. But they didn't know where the first line of fight was. But anyway, the Germans, all of a sudden I realized I was in town. It was early in the morning, 4:55 in the morning when I went in. And I was walking down the street in Steinfeld. And I don't know how far I was in town, blocks in town, when, excuse me, but all hell broke loose in behind. The Germans and Americans shooting and shells, mortars and all that. And I just hit the edge where I was walking along the edge of the street, and I just hit the edge of the street laying down with all that going behind me, and it was shrubbery right beside where I laid out. And right on the other side of that shrubbery, there was a church. I didn't realize it. And here was the Germans in some kind of little old bivouac type little tents where they were sleeping, you know, some of them back in reserve that far back. I could reach through the shrubbery and touch them, and all that German talk, and here I was back in behind German lines, and they headed back just where I was headed and where I'd been. And well, it wasn't for the next about 3 hours. I was in basements, and the only thing that helped me then wasn't me, it was Jesus or God just kept me from being killed. And anyway, I'd eased on. I'd gotten back waiting for the, you know, our company to come on up through there. And the Germans were making a counterattack, throwing shells, just bombing continuously. And I just ran for, it'd been about 3 hours out behind the line. And just, I don't know, it was a miracle I got through it. But anyway, I just about got shot with my own boys when I went through, and they were standing beside a pillbox. And inside the pillbox, I was so mad. The only person they wanted to kill in my life was Lieutenant Shaw. And I meant to, you know, for 3 hours I was in behind the German lines, and I can't tell you how bad it was, but anyway, Munzenberger, he said I was crying and mad, and I was. I was scared and mad, but I said something undoubtedly about. But anyway, he took my gun, and Munzenberger Lieutenant Shaw was back over behind a whole bunch in the pillbox because they were shelling us so. And anyway, I apologized to him later, and anyway, we went on fighting that morning. And about 11 o'clock, we'd gone through, it was terrible, the Germans that was killed, and out of that 1,000, that morning, it was 207 of us Americans that was either killed or wounded at that morning, and I think it was a lot more Germans than that. But before I got hit, Cox, we were going around the back of a building, and I started around, he grabbed my arm and said, "Oh, let me go, I got this M16 and I can cover y'all when y'all come around the corner, when we cross over a little opening area, maybe 20 feet wide." And he made about one step. I hadn't gone out, but he stepped about one step, I believe, and it must have been two machine guns. Cut him, and he fell right back at my feet, and I reached down and had blood coming out of his mouth, and he looked and never said a word, and I grabbed him and tried to raise him up, but he was shot through the chest, I don't know how many times, but Anyway, he was dead, and I took a dog tag. You always, when someone was killed like that, you put the dog tags in their mouth, so a little click in there where, when they get cold, that's where the people would know who they are eventually when somebody found them. But anyway, we went on. I left him there. He saved my life, and just shortly right after that, Munsonburger crawled around, going around the corner of a building, and he was on one side of a little old building, and he had his rifle leaning up against the side of a building, and he was throwing hand grenades. Germans were making a counterattack, and I looked around the left side of the building, and just when I looked around, a German just stepped out, maybe about the length of the building, maybe 20 or 30 feet. And I had to shoot right-handed, so I had to kind of step out a little ways from the corner of the building. And I had fired about three times at it. I'm sure somebody else was shooting at him the same time, too. But by that time, a shell hit the corner of the building, and what the Germans were throwing at us. And it just sent me whirling, concussion, just rolling back. And it just happened to be our medic, Johnson, was right close, right at me, and he was grabbed me and got me up and carried me into this house and set me down on the sofa, and he gave me a couple of shots of morphine and whatever, cocaine or whatever, and then looked at me and laughed, and he said, "Whitey," said, "you lucky son of a bitch," said, "you're gonna get to go home now." And I thought I was dying. I said, "Well, if I get to go home, it's not as bad as I think." And he said, "But I cannot put a tourniquet around you. Your jaw's busted. I can't put a tourniquet around your neck. I'm going to show you which way to go to get out of here." And when I started walking back and didn't realize I had that a 3-inch piece of shrapnel that went through my jaw and knocked out 13 of my teeth and busted the jaw on the other side. And when I was shooting the gun, that's when I was hit. So I had the gun up to my right shoulder and my face, you know, I'd love to have seen the butt of that M1 rifle. But anyway, I started back and I realized I had blood in my right boot. And I had shrapnel was in my right shoulder. But anyway, walking back down this side street, he said, "You walk down this street and it'll take you to the out edge of town. And there's a great vineyard up there that you go across, excuse me, where you just walk in between the grapevines, you know, how the grape vineyard they call, and go over this hill and you run back into the Dragon's Teeth, and that's where the ambulance and the doctors are right there to help you." And I got shot at twice walking down the street where we'd bypass Germans up in the attics of buildings. But they missed me. The bullet just hit the street right close right at me. And got to the out edge of town, the last house or last building. When I went around the back side of it, here was this boy crying, and he said, he just about shot me, and he said, "Can I help you?" And I couldn't talk. I just shook my head, "Yes." And we started up across a great vineyard, and I'd already lost so much blood, I was getting a little bit weak, and I put my left arm on his shoulder, and we was walking up through there, and he said he was so scared that morning at 4:55, all that shooting and killing, and he said, "I've been hid back here, and I know I'm going to be court-martialed for this," and he was crying and going on, and anyway, just on uphill, he had to put his arm around my waist, and I was holding, I had my arm around his shoulder up there holding on because I'd gotten so weak I'd lost so much blood. But anyway, he was just carrying me, I reckon, when we got back to where the doctors were. And they were giving me blood when I came to. And it's like in a corn, a barn or something. And I never will forget the nurse. There's a black-headed young nurse was holding my head, had a finger in my little jaw where blood, I wouldn't get choked on it, I reckon. Had blood all over and looking at me, grinning. But I'll back up that boy that was had got scared and had let us go on into town fighting. He didn't. He saved my life, or I would have died up on in that grape vineyard, because he carried me back. That's where I would have died there. And I'm sorry, I don't know his name. I tried every way to find out who he was, but I never could find out. But anyway, from that point, they carried me back to the doctor, when a bunch of ambulances was there, and all of them had been gone, taking the boys back as was wounded. There was only one ambulance left, and he said, call the ambulance driver in here, I want to talk to him. I could hear him telling somebody. And the ambulance driver came in, I won't say all that, but he said, take this soldier, he's bleeding, I can't get it stopped, and get him back to the hospital, back hospital somewhere. And said, my orders are to don't move until you get four in here. And I won't tell you what the doctor told him, but anyway, two of us was in that ambulance, left out going fast, and put me in there and laid my face down, so on the canvas, on the cot. And the boy in there with me, he smelled like he'd gone to the bathroom. He'd been shot through the stomach, and he was in bad shape, but he was about to get sick with me, looking at me with the blood running out my mouth. But anyway, we got back there and they worked on me. The doctor that night, he told me it was like 12 or 1 o'clock at night. And he said, soldier, I've got to take a break. Said, I've been up here working on y'all for 34 hours now and I've got to get some sleep. And said, this French doctor is going to work with you on, and said, he doesn't understand English, and I don't know whether you understand French or not, but said, he's good. And so he left, and that I'd already hurt for so long since about 11 o'clock that morning. This was 13 or 14 hours later, and I wanted them to leave me alone. And they had me strapped down on the table, and I could still move my head, so they had this boy had his hand on my forehead holding it. And I don't remember that, but they said the next morning when they came in, they had us stacked in like a warehouse or something. They had us so close together, the nurse and doctor had to walk sideways to get down between the bunks. And anyway, the nurse looked at me and she laughed and said, the doctor here said that you were mean to him last night. Said you even spit on him when he was working in your mouth. But I couldn't apologize. I couldn't talk to him, but I was sorry. But anyway, this went on for about 6 or 7 days. They still had my right shoulder just strapped over and taped down where they hadn't taken that as a 3 inches long, about the size of your little finger, a little smaller than your little finger. It was embedded in my shoulder. And anyway, I was about out of it again. And they came in, there was two doctors, two majors. The record shows a major and a colonel. And I don't remember this hardly, but they talked to me and thanked me for what I'd accomplished, and gave me the Bronze Star and Purple Heart and the Combat Infantry Badge, and pinned it on the pillow, so they say I was just out of it. And when they left, the chaplain, he held my hand and prayed for me and told me to be in touch with my family, and left, and I was just out of it too. And I heard one of the boys down just close by, he said, they just read him his last rites. He's dying. He won't be here about 2 or 3 more hours. And I did ask God if he would just get me back to the States. I'd never bother him again, which I have let him down there. I have bothered him a lot. But anyway, about 3 or 4 days later, I came to, and I was in Dijon, France, at the 36-year-old hospital. In the 36-year-old hospital, I stayed there for 5 weeks before they got my face cleared up and got the only time they ever put me to sleep was when they took that shrapnel out of my shoulder. The rest of the time they had to, just to kind of numb me, but they were afraid I'd get choked if it was opening my, if it put me to sleep while I was operating, working on my jaw. After 5 weeks approximately, I'm not positive of this, but they were sending me down to Marseille on the Mediterranean Sea to a hospital ship. And they had me outside thinking to load me in the ambulance to take me down to Marseille, down on the Mediterranean. And the major that had operated on me for 5 weeks, the doctor there, came out to tell me goodbye. And he had my jaw, my lower jaw was in 3 pieces. Had them wired together and had rubber bands, so all I could, had tubes up my nose, you know, to feed me. Had little funnels on top of my head where they pour liquids in them and go. And he looked at me and said, I was standing up talking to him. I said, I want you to lay back down on that cot and don't you move. Said, I'm gonna see if I can fly you home instead of, if you get on that ship, I'm afraid you might get seasick and you could choke to death. Well, I put back, lay back down after shaking his hand and saluting him, thanking him for what he had done for 5 weeks for me. He put me back on the cot, on the rolling cot, and rolled me back into the Dijon to the hospital. And I stayed there maybe about a couple hours, and all of a sudden they were back out, rolling me out, putting me in the ambulance, and took me to the airport. And when I got over there at the airport, it was this was back years ago in 44. But this was in 45, March 21st. They had a dirt runway, and here's a C-47, a twin-engine plane sitting there, and had a forklift there. And when they took me out of the ambulance, they put my, on the cot, they put it on the forklift and lifted it up and put me in through the side door of the cargo plane at C-47. And here I was, now I was a private in the service. And here I am being treated like a general. They had 2 men that got me when I went on in, 2 soldiers got me on the inside and put me on some type of cot there. And then the pilot and the co-pilot, anyway, we took off there. Here were 4 of them were carrying me from Dijon to Paris and by myself. And anyway, I got to Paris one of the boys came back and said, I want you to raise up and look. Said, he going to circle the Eiffel Tower. I want you to see that because you might not get back over to France, over to Paris. And I thought it was extremely nice of him. Anyway, we landed at the airport, and they, by ambulance, carried me to the First General Hospital in Paris. And there was a lot of the German prisoners. Anyway, 2 PWs had me on these rolling cots and went into the hospital and on the elevator and went up to the 34th floor and rolled out and went into this ward. It must have been 20 of us in there. But when I went through the door, I noticed there was an MP standing there with a gun. And he unlocked the door and then locked it back when they went in. And anyway, went on in there, and a little while, a nurse came to me, and I was telling her, I was catching a plane going on to Paris, going on home. And she said, yes, I know exactly what you're doing. She gave me a shot of morphine or cocaine or whatever, and I was out then for about 10 hours. And this went on, I'll make it short, I tried to talk to them, and every time I'd say something, they'd say, yes, I know it. And I noticed the boys in there were acting very strange, and they'd put me in a ward where where it was combat fatigue, where the boys had lost their minds on the front line. And they had a guard stand at the door all the time. And the nurse's office was right at the door. It was a glassed-in area where they could see what was going on of all of us back in there. And anyway, this went on for 6 days. I hadn't been to a doctor, and my jaws wired together, and there hadn't been a thing done. And I noticed that at 1 o'clock at night, when the guards were changed. He'd wait just a little bit, and then he'd come in and crack a door, open a door, and the nurse's door going into their office was right close, and he would go in there and talk to the nurse. This was like 1:30, excuse me. And the sixth night, I'd crawl up. I'd been four, 1 o'clock. I was up underneath the front bunk, right up underneath this. Whoever was there, one of the boys. And when they changed guards at 1 o'clock, about 15 or 20 minutes later, he opened the door and came in and left the door just cracked and went in the nurse's office. And I waited just a few minutes until he was seated in there talking to her. And I crawled out on my hands and knees and got to the door and eased it open. And just, anyway, I crawled on over to the edge of the elevator, and I thought I better not get on the elevator. It'll make a noise, and the staircase was right there. And I got on the staircase and walked down 34 floors. Excuse me. Got to the down, finally found the front desk. I don't know what time it was then. And I tried to tell the girl at the front desk, you know, what was happening. She said, "Let me see your dog tags." And I opened my pajamas and showed them to her. And she said, "Wait just a minute." She said, "We don't have any record of you even being here. And if you think back over when I left Dijon, I was headed down to Marseille on the Mediterranean Sea, and all my records had been shipped to down to the ship on the Mediterranean Sea, and I had no records whatsoever of me being there." She said, "You wait right here just a minute," and two nurses came out in just a little bit and got me and carried me down to the one of the emergency offices right there on the first floor. And this was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and the nurse, excuse me, doctor came in, and he looked at me, and I won't say what he said either, but the two nurses and the doctor, they finally took those rubber bands off and got into my mouth, and it hadn't been, I hadn't had a shave or my teeth brushed or anything, and it was a terrible situation. He said, "You got gangrene starting in your jaw." And he worked on me, and the words that he was saying about what was going to happen up to those nurses up in the 34th floor. But anyway, that morning, he worked on me for hours and got me straightened out anyway. He said, they called back to Dijon to the 36th General Hospital, and I've talked to the doctor that operated on me and had sent me to Paris and realized what had happened. Anyway, in about sometime on that morning, they were boarding me, carrying me out to the airport, and they did the same thing again, lifting me with a forklift up into a C-54, a four-motor propeller-driven plane that carried cargo, you know, that wasn't pressurized or anything. But they had bunks on the inside that, when they put me on there were 11 more soldiers on there. All of them were in a cast from their neck down. And there was two nurses and a doctor on the ship with us, and I was the 12th person. And anyway, they flew me from, I was out of it again. And anyway, when we left out, we flew from Paris to the Azores, which is about 8 hour flight. And after I'd been asleep for a good little bit on the way down there, I don't know how many hours, the nurse was standing right beside me then, and I raised my head up. I said, I gotta go to the bathroom. She said, wait a minute, I'll get you whatever you go to the bathroom in. And I said, no, I can walk. And she said, you can't walk. Everybody's supposed to be in a cast or down where they can't go. And I told her, I've got to go. I can't go. I've got to walk. And you should have noticed the doctor and what he said and the other nurse, but they laughed about it that I was able to go to the bathroom and I'd got on the plane to come back, you know, instead of on a ship. I was flying. They were flying me back. But anyway, we landed at the Azores and refuel, and it brought food on for everybody. And at that time, I was well acquainted with the doctor and nurses and whatever. And so I was off the plane for a little bit there in the Azores, and it was just hot down there. And anyway, we left out of the Azores and we headed to Newfoundland, about an 8 hour flight there. Now, we were coming back to the United States, but you couldn't fly. Get enough of fuel on there for it to fly straight from Paris to New York. We flew to Newfoundland, and when we landed in Newfoundland, we just left the Azores, and here it was hot down there. And when we got to Newfoundland, everything was snow and ice. And anyway, they refueled us again, brought food in, and then from Newfoundland, we flew from Newfoundland to New York. And on the way from there, we hit an air pocket and must have dropped, I don't know how far. Anyway, one of the boys, it was in a cast from his neck down, was thrown out on the floor, and he started bleeding and had no means of cutting the cast open to get into him. And anyway, the boy died before we got to New York. But that was a hard situation. But anyway, we landed in New York and they carried us to this, I don't know where it was. And they had us all on the inside of a building, and some of the boys were calling on the phone. And I had not, when I lost my money going overseas in that poker game, my $39, I never had another penny in my pocket through England, France, Germany, and Dijon. Not a paycheck ever caught up with me. I didn't never had a penny the whole time I was overseas. And anyway, this fella with a suit on, necktie and everything, came to me and he said, "Soldier, I'm glad to have you back and everything." And said, "You're not calling home?" And I told him, "No, sir, I didn't have any money." And he said, "Give me the number you gonna call." And I told him, and he called it and handed the phone to me, and I must have talked at home for 15 minutes. I didn't mean to talk that long, but anyway, when I handed the phone back to him, I thanked him, and but he was extremely nice to me, and I don't know, even having any idea who he was or anything. But they were sending me to Walter Reed right outside of Washington to the hospital. And before I left there, they came in and said, "We're sending you to Newton D. Baker General Hospital in Martinsburg, West Virginia. There's a ward there that everybody's shot in the mouth. And that's where we're sending you." And so they flew me to Martinsburg, West Virginia. And there I stayed for, I think, about 11 months. But anyway, there, after a few months, Major McQuaid told me, he said, I want you to, I'm going to give you a 30-day pass to go home. And if you promise me you won't do anything. His jaws all messed up. And he was just eating with liquids. Well, I want to back up just one thing. When I left New York going overseas, stripped, I weighed 174 pounds. And when I got back into New York at that, where I called home, I had on combat boots and a field jacket, and the Red Cross had given me a bag, I think it was apples, and I had my jaw wired together and stuff, and they weighed me, and I weighed 111 pounds. That's what how I had lost that much weight at, in Dijon in Paris. But anyway, the he said, I'm sending you home for 30 days. We're going to take one of your ribs out and place it in your jaw, and you're going to be here for a long time. So I went home, and it was about in August. This was March 21st when I was hit, and I think it was about August or something when I was home. Anyway, it was winding up peach season, and the next day I was on the tractor with helping haul peaches out of the orchard, which I wasn't lifting anything. But anyway, I stayed for 30 days at home, and I called Major McQuaid after, right before my time was up. I said, I'd like to stay another week, and he let me. And when I got back to Martinsburg, the first day when I got back, I was taking it over to x-rays, you know, just right away. These German prisoners, we had 1,600 German prisoners up there with us at Martinsburg. And that, and there were about 3,500 or 3,600 of us up there was wounded, been shot. And, but I had one, I'm backing up just a little bit. One German that stayed with me, every time I'd get out of the bed, he'd be standing right behind my bed, leaning up against the wall. I'd go to the bathroom, when I'd get back, he'd have a towel laying on the floor and the bed turned down. I'd get back to bed, he'd help me turn the covers back over on me, which I didn't need any help, but he was over about 11 months, he was extremely nice to me. I was real close to him. But you had, when I got back, I'll jump back now to where I got back from the farm. They did x-rays, and one but about 30, 40 minutes, they were back in there again and said, more x-rays. I went back, carried me down and did x-rays again. And then about an hour or two later, came up and said, Major McQuaid wants to see you in his office. And I went down there, and he said, I can't believe what I'm seeing. Said, I've been in the bone business and doing this for a long time, but he said, I want you to see this yourself. Where that shrapnel had gone through the left side of my jaw, which is about maybe close to a half inch, because all the bone was knocked out. And it looked like a 100 hairs, just a, you could hardly see them, had knitted all the way across my jaw. That where it, and he said, we're going to wait just a little bit. I'm not going to cut in there and cut that out. He said, I've never seen anything like this before. So this went on for a few months, and did more x-rays continuously. And the thing, my jaw knitted back across where that shrapnel had gone through. And anyway, he said, you're going to have about half strength of your jaw, but he said, it's going to be better than what if I had taken one of your ribs out and placed it in your jaw. It'd probably be better like this. And so they did work on my face, taking this, how, you know, how when a scar comes up, there's a little ridge they pull out and go all around on your face and try to get it fixed up. But anyway, that over a period of time. And anyway, at the end, they gave me my discharge at Newton D. Baker General Hospital, and they carried me down to the, we had a church there. It was no denomination. Everybody went to it, and carried me down the front of the church, and a couple of officers, and there was about four or five people. Anyway, gave me my discharge then, and went through a whole rigmarole. And I was fixing to head home, but I said, I want to see Major McQuaid again. He's worked with me all this time. I went back up to the office, to his office, and I told the nurse, I said, I just want to see him, tell him goodbye. He said, you can't go in there. He's got all these patients out here. He's got to see, and I said, I'm going to go in the side door where I usually go. All I want to do is just tell him goodbye. And she said, okay, go ahead. And I went back through a door and back in there, and I opened the door, and I said, I want to see you just a minute. And he said, wait a minute. And he got through with the patient he had in there, and we talked for a minute, and I said, I just want to thank you for helping me out all these 11 months and 10 days or whatever that I was there. And he said, where are you headed? I said, I've got my discharge. I'm headed in, headed home. And he said, well, wait just a minute. I'm going to take you in town, which is about 9 miles in from the hospital into the bus station. He called a nurse back, and he said, I'm taking Whitesides in town. She said, you've got 15, 20 people out here waiting on you, sitting in the waiting room right now. And he said, I'm going out the back door, and said, you just tell them I've had an emergency. And he took me out there and got me in the car, and we went into the bus station, and I know it, 20 minutes getting into there, and he was gone 45 minutes, I bet, before he got back. And anyway, he went in the bus station with me, and it was a major. And I was promoted to a PFC by that time. Made $54 a month with the promotion. And anyway, the major, we shook hands and I saluted him, and then he had to hug me, help me right close, and looked at me in the eye and thanked me for what I'd done, and I thanked him. And anyway, we left, and I caught a bus. Anyway, got home, and a few months later, Sid accepted me as a husband, and that was one of the best things that ever happened in my life. Sid married me, and we got married, and we have had two boys, Dick and Steve. And I won't go through all the names, but we've got 17 of extremely nice people. I couldn't ask for anything better. And Jesus has been extremely nice to me to give me all this stuff. And I'm 82 and a half years old, and I've had a happy life, and everything's been so nice to me. I try not to ever complain about anything, and it's just been a beautiful life. And I thank y'all. Talk to you later. Bye.